difference. One cup at a time.
Tea time.
Yeah, this is tea time.
Yeah.
Making a difference. One cup at a time.
Tea time.
So be sure to grab your tea, grab a seat, and tune in to Miss Liz.
Tea time. Making a difference. One cup at a time.
Good morning and welcome to Tea Time with Miss Liz. That's right, I am back and we are at the end of November. We are on the last three for November and then we have seven left and then we're doing the amazing reunion Tea Time where you see guests from season one, two, three, and four. And we have the largest audience coming back this year. We have over 75 attendees so far. There are still more coming in. We have 14 different countries that will be joining that reunion. So be sure to check that out. But this morning, I have the amazing Audrey Burr-Brown joining me. And we're going to be talking about the Holocaust and the story that she wrote, her father's story. So we're going to talk about the American Wolf. So tune in, grab your tea, grab your coffee, grab your breakfast. If you haven't subscribed to the YouTube channel, go ahead, do that right now and ring that little bell so that you're notified when all those tea times come live. Each and every tea time is different. We do do different topics, different flavors, and different blends from all over the globe. So we do want to get Audrey in here. So, but before we get started with that, we're going to do the disclaimer and we're going to get Audrey in here right after I do a little bit of her bio as well. So stay tuned for that. We're going to get that going and then we're going to get Audrey in here and we're going to spill you a good strong cup of TEA this morning. And yes, as you can notice, my voice is a little choppy this morning. I am fine. It's just from having a little bit of crying from my grandma passing, but I am fine. So if my voice gets a little too choppy, I'm sorry for all the listeners out there if it's a little rough on your little ears. So the disclaimer for Miss Liz's live Tea Time live show. Miss Liz myself is going live using StreamYard. Before leaving a comment, please grant StreamYard permission to see your name at StreamYard.com. Please be advised that the content brought forward for any Tea Time show hosted by myself, Miss Liz, is always brought forward in good faith. However, it may bring forth dialogues and opinions that are not representative of my platform. The facts and information are perceived to be accurate at the given time of airing. All Tea Time guests and audience participants are responsible for using their good judgment in taking any action that may relate to the discussion. The content brought forward may include discussions for some where they may be emotionally at risk. It's significant to know that the show is engaging in discussion forums only to offer and inspire awareness and connection and is not providing therapeutical advice. If you have any questions about the disclaimer or the panelist discussion, you may freely contact me, Miss Liz, through my email at bookingmissliz@gmail.com. Moving forward, should you choose to voluntarily participate in today's show in any aspect, I myself, Miss Liz, welcomes you. And should you decide that the show is not made for you at this time, I respect your wishes and will see you at a later show at a later date and time. And again, all tea times in 2023 are done on Thursday, 10, 3, and 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And if you see a tea time that's not on a Thursday, it's a rescheduled tea time or it's a surprise guest that wants to come back for a second cup of tea. So now a little bit on Audrey. Who is Audrey? Well, let me get a little bit on Audrey. So Audrey, let me get her over here. Audrey Birbaum is a let me see. Audrey now enjoys singing, writing, reading, and being with friends who also had quirky childhoods. She lived with her husband in Westchester County, New York, and has three marvelous grown children. Audrey is currently working on her second book, but we're going to talk about the first book. So Audrey, growing up in the 1960s, Birbaum assumed that watching Holocaust documentaries was a perfect, normal family activity. On her first day of elementary school, Audrey sat in the cafeteria, unwrapped her liverwurst sandwich, and excitedly told her new classmates about her public television prolactity. Her Brady Bunch watching peers had never heard of PBS, but they had heard of PB&J, and they weren't too keen on the liverwurst either. They made it abundantly clear Audrey's childhood was, in fact, not normal at all. So let's get Audrey in here and let's find out how her childhood was and all of that good stuff. So let me get her in here. Welcome, Audrey.
Hi, Ms. Liz. How are you? Thank you for having me.
I am not too bad. Well, first of all, I want to thank you for joining me and that. I really appreciate. And this is a story that may trigger people. So if it's too hard, I do appreciate that if you can't tune in. But Audrey, let's start as a little girl, that little girl in the cafeteria. So who were you as a little girl and who are you now as a grown woman?
I cry a little for that little girl. I think I would sum it up by saying sometime in second grade, my very astute teacher, Mrs. Lerman, took me into the teacher's bathroom and she picked me up and put me on the windowsill. And she said to me, "Audrey, is everything okay at home?" And I'm not sure even like what it was that led to that, but obviously she saw that not everything was okay at home. So it's hard for me to see objectively what was going on with me, but obviously something wasn't right. And I think, it was a combination of, I was being bullied at school. I was really different from all the other kids. And, I think like a combination of being sort of, as a first generation American, with a European parent who was trying to, keep up those, European cultures and American cultures, which made me different from everybody else. I also, my father had a lot of like OCD and control issues to try and sort of keep everything together, which was a result of his Holocaust experiences, his trauma of childhood. And when things weren't together, he would fly off the handle, and the atmosphere at home had a kind of an abusive quality to it, because we were living in fear of like when dad was going to go, off the handle. So I think, it was kind of scary at home. And so I think like my sister and I, we had each other, which was great, but I think we were sort of scared children who felt very different from everybody else. I guess that's the best way that I would describe it. I would say that it built some grit and resilience, so not all bad. And, it was not an unloving home. It just was not a normal home.
I totally get that, because before we went live, like we shared to each other, we both have family members that come from the Holocaust. My Oma that gave me the tea and that. And they did have that form of OCD. I believe it, a lot of them, because of what they went through so when did you realize growing up as a child that you were a survivor, like your father was a survivor of the Holocaust?
So we were exposed really, as I said in the little bio, we were exposed so incredibly early to the Holocaust. That we really, from the time I can remember, 5 years old, if not younger, we were watching, the Shoah documentaries about the Holocaust, you know, black and white, mass graves, emaciated bodies, you know, all, everything, you know, Hitler speeches, you know, raving speeches. As long as I can remember, we knew about the Holocaust way before we were mature enough to understand it and not be traumatized by it. We knew my father was an escapee from Nazi Germany. We knew stories, but we just didn't have the understanding and maturity to understand them, to have a perspective and a context. And we kind of grew up knowing, and then at some point we just stopped talking about it. It was just sort of understood. Okay, Dad was a survivor. He wasn't in a concentration camp. He was an escapee, but he still went through the war. He didn't escape until 1941, which was very late. And then the details were kind of at some point just lost and forgotten. And we didn't really pick up on them till we found he had written, you know, 350 pages of very, very vivid details of his story that we found after he had died in 2018. But yeah, so we knew about it. We were somehow like entrenched in it, and yet to know and not know, if that makes any sense.
Yep.
Because we were too young to really know. So it's like we lived it, but without understanding it.
So Audrey, you said your dad escaped in 1941. So was he part of the ones that got through the, there was a tunnel, I believe, in the Holocaust?
No. He was not. There were desperate efforts to, that his family made to try to get out. They were a little bit late in trying to apply for a visa to get to the U.S. And then when they did apply, there was tremendous resistance to immigration from all over the world. And the United States actually put up significant barriers intentionally, the State Department did, to slow down the process of immigration. And there was actually written statements to say, whatever you do, delay, postpone. But they didn't realize that. They just thought they had terrible luck. Like, why are we not getting our papers? Why? And so time was just running out. And they had crazy schemes to try to see like what we can do. Should we go to China? Should we escape across the border and bribe guards? It's just really crazy. And they were really like literally on like the last train Germany heading west, because after they left, everybody else was, there were these mass transports deporting everybody east, where they were basically shot on arrival and put into mass graves. So they were, without giving away too much of the story, but they were, their path out was insane, edge of your seat, nail biting experience, and pretty harrowing and quite extraordinary. And then my father, you know, besides then when he came here, it was pretty difficult transition, you know, in some ways it's like a typical immigrant's tale, but in some ways more tragic than that. But then he returned to Germany as a spy for U.S. intelligence. Because he had that's why the title is
I wanted to get into the spy, because I was like, how did he get the spy? Sometimes you just see the title of a book and you're like, oh my goodness, like how did he do that? Like how, you know, this is like a film, like a movie, right? And you're like, how did he become the spy? Like what did he do? Like
it really was like a movie. A couple of reviewers had said this should be a Spielberg movie, and I'm like, yes, please, Steven, read the book.
But you just never know, right? Who's watching Tea Time and who's gonna word of mouth, right? And because the story does have a good storyline to it, you know, just reading just the little blippets that are online, you know, without even reading the book, it's like, oh, how did he do this? Like, where did he go? You know? So
it was a good returning to Germany. It was in the Cold War, and returning to Germany as a spy was a great bookend, you know, to the story. I mean, that's where I decided to end it, because so much of his story was one of identity too, of like, you know, who am I? You know, I was rejected as a German. I lost my citizenship. I was rejected as a Jew. Then I came to America and everyone was anti-Semitic. No one wanted me here either. Plus, we were in the middle of the war and everyone hated the Germans and they were calling me a Nazi. That's really what happened. They called him a Nazi when he got to America, which was, you know, the irony, I think we can say, was, you know, pretty incredible. And then, you know, so he went back to Germany and had to sort of grapple with what his identity was as a, you know, was he German? Was he Jewish? Was he American? He was trying so hard to become an American. And that's the title of the book, American Wolf, is, you know, it's not about the animal, the American Wolf, but his given name was Wolf. And he, when he came here, he had to give up his name Wolf. He was told by the school principal that like, you better give up your name Wolf because you'll be teased mercilessly. And so he gave it up and changed it to Jack, which he thought was like, you know, symbolize America. You know, somebody said, become Jacob. And he's like, nah, too Jewish. And so he became Jack. And he tried so hard to become an American. And he never really, like, to the end of his days, he never really quite got it. Because you never really do when you're an immigrant. You never really quite get, you know. You know, he lost most of his accent, but whenever he said Lincoln, he always pronounced the second L. It's like Lincoln. It's like, that's the one thing, like, I was like, you know, Dad, it's Lincoln. It's just, like, you know, he always, like, retained a little bit of that. So he, to me, like, American Wolf was, like, just, like, the perfect title because it was really about his journey to try to become an American. And then in the end, you know, when he goes back to Germany and he's homesick. He's homesick for Germany. A lot of people were, you know, any immigrant, they're homesick for their home. It doesn't matter that they threw him out. He wanted to go back, and then he had to figure out who was he after being rejected everywhere. And so that was like a good endpoint. Plus it was really interesting going back and then the whole thing of what Americans did after being at war with Germany, but then accepting Nazis because they were now fighting communism, which is, you know, a fascinating part of history. So, you know, of course he came out traumatized from the experience. He lost so much. It's just like a series of losses. And the outcome of that is that he held on so desperately, you know, to what he had so that he became, you know, quite compulsive and frightened, you know, always waiting, you know, for when the other shoe was going to drop. And that affected, of course, our upbringing tremendously. To this day, Liz, really affected us. How many hours do you have?
I've got lots of hours. We can
where's the couch? Where's
tea all day. We both have things that we have to, right? After this tea time. But I want to get into when you grew up, were you in your house, did they speak, and did your dad speak German, or did he just stop the language completely?
No, he spoke German to his mother. So I knew my Oma, and I know you told me you have an Oma as well. So I knew my Oma, who is a German speaking grandmother, who was, you know, German. I don't know, I can't speak for your grandmother, but my German grandmother was not a warm, fuzzy, like, you know, sometimes people have an idea, but the Jewish grandmother, you know, no, she was a German grandmother. She was, you know, she was good. She made us dresses and she she babysat for us and she took care of things and she did things, but she was not like fuzzy and like, you know, she was, you know, she spoke German. We didn't understand her well. She seemed old before her time. She walked around carrying her pocketbook harshly in the crook of her. She looked like Queen Elizabeth. She would carry her pocketbook like this. She was like, there was something, you know, but she was, I mean, she was, listen, she, if it wasn't for her, they never would have gotten out because my grandfather, who I never met, was kind of a character. He was a bit of a dreamer, which was what made for these great characters in the book because they just were these great characters. My grandfather was a clown, and some of his clowning actually helped them too, because they were very close. He was very close to getting deported twice. Once during Kristallnacht, the night of broken glass, when Jewish men were being rounded up, and there was another time when he was taking my aunt to England, and he got pulled off of a train by a band of Nazis, and his clowning around saved him from really certain deportation. So the two of them, Oma's persistence and diligence and hard work and drive and his antics were a good, good for survival, but did not make for a happy household, but made for wonderful book characters, you know?
Yeah.
So even though the book is nonfiction, it really reads like fiction because you have these great, wonderful characters and a great adventure story in a way, full of, edge of your seat, things that happen and emotion and drama and life and death and love and blah, all these things. So it was great. The story wrote itself.
So Audrey, because your grandfather, the one that you never met, was like a clown, did your dad have a little bit of that sense of humor from time to time?
Totally. I mean, that was the thing about my father is like he could be, anything about him that felt abusive. Like, I think when I was young, I didn't really appreciate it, obviously, but it was always out of fear, that again of like losing control of things, and he was trying to pull it together. But he had a whimsical side, and he had a great appreciation for music, for art, for a sunrise, for a flower, just a tremendous appreciation for those things, and a definite goofiness. You could see both of his parents in him without doubt. I mean, he was definitely not. I think he had periods of depression, but I think he also had a lust for life as well. No doubt, Opa Arthur was in him, no doubt. And that's why I also I felt like it was, even though I had never met my grandfather, I felt he was easy to write. I could see him through my father. I could definitely imagine him. Plus, my father had written some specific stories about some of the things that he had done that were a little nutty and crazy. So, it was possible for me to weave that into the story. I could weave my bangs out of my eyes.
As you're sharing about your Oma and all of that, growing up, I always thought my Oma was mad at me because of the way that they spoke, right? With that. And I was like, okay, she's mad at me. What did I do? It was like she was angry. And then I would cry a lot and she'd be like, why are you crying? And I'd be like, I don't know. Because her English was really hard when we were younger. But as she got older, her English started to get a little bit better. Is she slowly lost the German, right? But she would teach us little words in Germany, in German, and kind of just give us that story of when it gets too serious, crack a joke. When it gets too heavy for you, crack a joke. And I'd be like, but that's not the right time to crack a joke there, Oma. And we got close because I was that little girl that was that shy, quiet one, where she came with this sternness and she was like, I'm going to toughen you up, and gave me that tea. But she had the biggest heart out there. She would turn. It was like the one moment she was really nice. The next moment it was like, you better behave yourself. She'd give you this look and it'd be like, oh, okay. We're not going there.
I don't want to generalize, but I don't think the German culture is known for being effusive, in their nature. But I don't think that means that there's no, that there isn't love or heart there. It's just a different style. It's a style, a cultural style. But I once, my grandmother once made dinner for me and my sister, and I went home to my parents and they said, how was it? And I said, I complained that the portions were too small. And then my parents told my grandmother and I got an earful, oh my God, of like the, the insults and the horror. It's like, oh my God. She was so mad. She was so mad. But it was true. Everything, that was also true. There was never a sense of like generosity. Everything was apportioned, everything was controlled, everything was, yes, that's how we grew up. Measured. It was a measured house.
Well, I think it's what they were taught, right? So that's what the pattern, the cycle of falling into it. You know, like you mentioned, the OCD with your dad. My Oma was the same way, was severe OCD. She had her little purse all the time, too. It was like this little doctor's purse, like little black purse. And she had like all her stuff in there. And if anything ever happened to her, that was the purse that you needed to go to, you know. So, you know, there's a story behind the Holocaust that, you know, we can get some positive from it. You know, because from every pain and suffering, there's a positive message. It's on how we treat people and how the humanity is in the world, right? Because look, we're going through it again. We're repeating the same patterns because we didn't listen to the first time it happened. You know, we're seeing it today in today's world, you know, where people are going to war again because they're not understanding the story that was in the past, you know. So I want to get into the I found something about the ships that I want to get into, the horror ships.
Yes.
And I seen that you have some of the images, and in the images on your website, you have 15 people were supposed to be on this ship, but there was over 1200, I believe.
Yes. It was a slight over, you know how like the airlines overbook. They overbooked by 1192 or something like that. Yes, it was a little bit of overbooking. So a lot of people know about the ship, the St. Louis. It was a very famous ship that people, you know, who are somewhat familiar with Holocaust history. It was a tragic story of a ship that had, this goes back to like 1938, where people were still taking luxury liners. They paid a ticket, they got a board. The St. Louis was supposed to go to Cuba. People had papers, they had gotten proper papers, and they were going to go there and like wait out the problem and then maybe go back to Europe afterwards. But when it got to Cuban waters, Cuba suddenly like reneged and said, no, we don't want to take them. And America said, well, we don't want to take them either. Nobody wanted to take them. And so this, I think they had like maybe 800 or 900 passengers. And ultimately a bunch of countries in Europe, England and Denmark and Holland decided to take back the passengers. They were all split up, but about 300 people from that ship ended up being murdered because of course many people, Jews in Europe, ended up going into concentration camps. And so that's like a well-known tragic story of a ship. But the people on the ship did not have horrible conditions. They were people who had money who ended up, you know, they booked their ticket and they went. In 1941, people were desperate to get out and they got out any way they could. And my parents ended up, they already had missed a ship that was supposed to go to China. They had, that ship was supposed to leave from Genoa, Italy. And like on the day my father was supposed to take that ship, Italy joined the war. And so they couldn't go to Italy. Like, you know, once you were in the war, like you couldn't leave from the ports. So you always had to leave from a neutral country. So they had a ship leaving from Barcelona. And then by the time they got to Barcelona, their visas expired. And they couldn't board the ship. If you didn't have a valid visa to the US, you couldn't board the ship. That was the rule. So then they were like racing through Spain to try to find another ship. And they had help. Some of the people who helped them in Spain were the volunteers, Quakers, unbelievably helpful. And there were other people, there were like people who, Jews who had converted to Christianity because you couldn't live in Spain unless you were Christian. But you, as a Jew, you could only pass through Spain. So you could only, they also only had a window of like 2 weeks to pass through Spain. Otherwise, they'd be deported back to Germany. So there were, those were all like the barriers that they were facing, tremendous like bureaucratic barriers. If you didn't have the right paperwork at the right time, this visa expired, that visa expired. You had to leave Spain. You had to leave. I mean, it was unbelievable, like bureaucratic nightmare. So they ended up on this ship called the Navamar, which was leaving from Seville. And it was a freight ship. And they basically took the holds of the freight ship, which were made for like rubber and, you know, steel and things like that. And they lined them up like the way a concentration camp would look, with like three bunks high, bunks all across, and each hold held about 300 people, and they were below, no air, nothing. Wow. And it was a multi-week trip across the water, which about a third of the people developed dysentery. And so everybody was sick, and they were basically, and the crew just basically went on strike and said, we're not cleaning, we're not doing anything. And some of the crew actually attempted a mutiny and wanted to turn the ship around. That particular ship that they were on, it turned out Chagall's family was, I think his daughter was on the ship, and some of his artwork was on the ship. And a lot was written about the boat when they got here. There were tons of newspaper articles, a lot of press across the country, because it was so horrific. The conditions were so horrific. But it hasn't gotten a lot of attention in any of the like books that have been written. And it is one of the big, you know, catastrophic events. I mean, many of the people, of course, did make it here alive, but it's just not much has spoken about it. And I think it's, you know, another story, I think, worth telling that people don't know about how the conditions people had to go through to come here, and how, again, how traumatic the experience was. In the end, people couldn't live below ground because just the sick were there. They were sick, dying in their own excrement, and everybody crowded aboard the deck just to get air. And they had no refrigeration because it wasn't meant to be a passenger ship. So they brought live animals on board, and they were killing them for food on board the ship. So it's, you know, it is really a fascinating piece of history that I now have given away. So I don't have to buy it.
But you know, she gave you a little tidbit, guys. You know, you can always
use the emotional content.
But Audrey, what I liked about when I went to your site and I got to get some information, I was like, we didn't hear about these ships. We didn't hear about how they got out, how they, you know, because there was still hell for them just to get out of the hell. You know, it was a trend. There was a lot of transfer that wasn't spoken of about the Holocaust, how their survivors actually got out. And that's what I liked about finding that information, is was knowing that my Oma and my Opa, you know, went through these camps and went through this process to get here, gives you a better perspective on understanding why they were the way they were, you know, why they were so stern, why they were like, you know, appreciate that slice of bread, you know, whether it had a little bit of mold on it or not, you cut the mold off and you ate the bread. You know what I mean?
I still cut the mold off. And I still eat the bread. Okay. I'll be honest with you. You know, those habits die hard. You know, what's a little mold? I'm a gastroenterologist. I know you didn't mention I'm a physician, and I'm going to tell you, a little mold never hurt anybody.
Well, that's it, right? Because they use mold for penicillin. Like, you know, these are things that people don't.
What's a little mold? That's a different conversation.
But we actually grew up appreciating stuff a little bit more, you know, like as you said, like when you went and had dinner at your Oma's and you came home and you got like an earful because you were like, there was not enough. But for them, that was a lot. You know, so
they had nothing. I have like a story in the book, you know, totally true. Everything in the book is 100% true, but it's just written in a form that's, you know, very digestible and emotional and readable, about how they celebrated a birthday. And, you know, they went to the store and all I could find was like an orange and a potato, and they made like a glorious meal out of it because that's what you did. You know, it's and listen, I mean, that story is not unique to the Holocaust, right? That could be a depression story, yeah, or a potato famine story. You know, it's just not unique. But and people who've had, you know, those kinds of hardships could listen. You know, I read Angela's Ashes too. You know, I mean, like, listen, you can write a book about. I mean, hardship does make for great literature and great human experiences, and a lot of good comes out of that, but also, you know, a lot of trauma too. But it does build resilience, you know, no question about it. And But yeah, it makes for good storytelling, and yeah, you do appreciate what you have, certainly, when you have less.
Right? Well,
That's
you understand a little bit more, and especially when you get older. When you're a child, right? So you don't understand the less. But when you get older, then you're like, oh, okay, now I understand why, So writing this story, your father's story, and finding these notes, Audrey, how did you feel like as an adult, knowing that he went through all of this?
I think that I think again, when I was younger, I had a lot of anger towards my father because, there was a lot of denial of things for us. Like, we couldn't go into college and we didn't have things. And, there was, and again, there was sort of like, some of the relationship was very volatile. But I think like after I had kids, I had really made peace with that, as an adult. But I think what I didn't have till I wrote the book is a full appreciation for what he had gone through. I didn't really realize like how much he had lost, how much over and over again, even after he came here, the loss is just stacked up. So I think I didn't have the sympathy for him. Like I had so much. Moment.
Nope,
Was it
it's
tears?
okay. You're
I
allowed to
think I
do
know
that
what
on tea
tears
time. I
is. If I was allowed to eat or drink, I would have a sip of something right now. But a procedure coming up after this. I had like a pity and sympathy for him that I, as I was writing it, that it was just like new and made me just feel such great, like mourning and sadness for him as a person and as the child, because I was writing in the first person because it was his story, so I wrote in his voice, and it started with his childhood. So I'm feeling for him as the child that he was, not just the adult that I knew, but the child that he was, who had like lost, like one first he can't go to school with his friends, and then his friends all leave him, and then he has to part from his, beloved uncle and aunt, and he's just like one thing after another after another, and then all of a sudden his home isn't, there's no furniture in the house, and then there's no food. It's just like this steady loss of, and then of course the thing here is like you think like ah, and they made it out, which even as I was like reading his story, I was always at the edge of my seat wondering, did they make it out? Are they going to get out? And that's always like the big joke because I'm alive, so of course I know they made it out. But it feels when you're reading it like you're at the edge of your seat because they have so many obstacles, and you're wondering, are they going to make it? And then, but they make it out, and you think like, oh, finally. And then like get here, and you're like, but it's not over. It's like. And I'm sure that's how it felt for a lot of people who, whether they survived a concentration camp or whether they made it here, is you think, oh, I'm free, and then you're like, oh, no, it's like it's now it's a whole new set of challenges are just beginning. Like I made it here. What happened to all my relatives? Oh, they didn't make it. I'm waiting and waiting to hear. There's a lot of no news, and then all of a sudden realizing that they probably didn't survive, or I'm like trying to get a start, and I'm poverty stricken, piss poor, so I think that's that real that crash of realization that freedom is not the like this sort of like light on the hill, but it's the just the start of a very difficult path forward. That just that realization for me was just also like very enlightening. But it's has the book has a lot of humor and a ha happy ending and love and a lot of excitement. So, but yeah, I felt really in terms of my relationship with my father, like I felt just yes, sadness and sympathy.
Well, and growing up in that up and down roller coaster home, right? It's not that they were, you know, again, they went through so much. And it was hard for them to understand when things were too, like, I know what my Oma, when it was too calm or too peaceful, she was like on guard. She was like, something's going to happen. We have to prepare. We have to be ready. We have to be. And I was like, why was she always on guard? Like, and she gave me that as a child, because I spent a lot of time with her and got to get her to tell me the stories on how, because she's a survivor, but her parents didn't make it. They got to the encamp, and, you know, so that's where the tea came in, is she said, you know what, when I came to Canada, I had a cup of tea and I sat, I recharge, reflect and release. And that's what I want you to do with your tea, my dear, is I want you to serve that way. I want you to serve life and look at life like that, you know, because life is hard. You're going to have that good. You're going to have that bad, but they were always on guard. They were always ready if they had to go, right? Like, it was always like, let's get out of here.
You sound like your grandmother, a wonderful perspective. I don't think that my father ever really developed a perspective. I think he was kind of stuck. But just to talk about like being on guard, like my sister once got a raise and my father said, I don't know, she'll price herself out of the market. and then she bought a house in the Hamptons, you know, when she was doing very well. She was single at the time. And he said, I know, she'll isolate herself. She'll never meet anybody. But she actually made a party and she met her husband at a party at her house. So there was like this always, like, nothing good was ever good. It was always like laced with the bad that could come from, you know, something good. It was never, nothing good was ever good. It was always, you know, I can understand.
And that had to have caused some form of trauma in you and your sister as well, you know, because every time you did something good, it's not good enough. Like, it's not, you know, we shouldn't be celebrating this. We shouldn't be getting too happy about this. Because I know that.
Yeah, that's still there. That's not going away. I don't think, I'm going to be 60 next week. It is not going away, Liz. It is not. I think at this point, it's too late for that.
Well, and that's why I wanted to have this story on here, because it's, your father was a survivor, but it was passed on to his children on how to be on guard as well. You know, we were given that. We were like, okay, if we can't celebrate this too much, because we don't deserve this. It's not meant for us. You know, I know when good things happen, I'm always like, oh, well, when's the bad coming? You know?
Yep. Yep. All I can say is, yes, I totally get it. And yeah, that's right. But I mean, I'm light years ahead of where, I mean, my sister and I are light years ahead of, you know, where my family was. We celebrate, we enjoy. I think, again, there's just the more deeply rooted psychological things are there. But we, in terms of how we live our lives, it's very different, you know, from how my parents lived their lives. But yeah, the psychological stuff is, you know, certainly there, but it's what it is. And you know, it's I still live my life without regret, and I'm not even sorry for my upbringing, because I know it made me more, you know, not only more resilient, but also like a certain amount of like ingenuity to sort of like, I didn't have things growing up, so I had to like invent them, create them, you know, sew them. You know, it's, you know, all that stuff is good.
Well, it gave you that grit, right? You said you got grit and resilience. Mm-hmm. And you know, sometimes that's what it takes, right, for us to get our resilience and keep going on. So Audrey, I want to ask you, how long did it take you to write the book?
For about 3 years. There were a lot of, like, you know, there was the initial writing. I toyed with it a little bit. I tried writing it, you know, in the present tense, and I tried in the past tense. And then, like, the first solid draft probably took like a year to a year and a half. And then I actually like queried it to agents, and I didn't get a response. And so I put it away, like, with that deep rejection of like, oh, nobody wants my book. And then, but after a while, I picked it up again and looked at it with fresh eyes. And I did a lot of rewriting of parts that I thought were weaker. And that time, I think I like really was a good thing, so that rejection was kind of good for me. So after picking it up and reworking it, that total time probably, I was just like another 6 months I spent on the rewriting. And I honestly could spend 10 years rewriting it, trying to make it better and better and better, so I think it's 3 years total is probably like the length of time.
Yeah, and the reason I asked that is because these stories are hard to tell, right? And for you to read all of these notes, it must have took some time to process it as well, And did you?
There was a lot of detail, but they were, it was dry. It was, some of it was out of order. Some of the facts were inaccurate, like historical facts were not quite accurate. They had to be fact checked. My father didn't know what happened to some of his relatives. I researched it and found out like what happened to friends and relatives that he had no knowledge of. He had no internet when he wrote down the notes. And then there was, the other thing was the tone. He put in like a, how do I put this? Like, what if I said to you, like he wrote, oh, my sister was like a lazy student. And she was like, his sister was much older than him. She was like 12, she was 9 years older than him. So he would be three, she was 12. And he would say like, she was a lazy student and she was a sour mouthed adolescent or something. I'm thinking like, how could he have said that? He was a child. How would he have like been able to make that judgment of her? And I'm starting to realize that his judgments in his writing are really not his, but really his mother's. And he somehow like enmeshed some of his thoughts and ideas, or he would say that one of his relatives, like an aunt, was ugly. And I'm like, you're a child. What do you mean she's ugly? Like you're five. What do you mean?
So
like,
I think that's how you got to tell the story of your grandfather, is because through the reading of the notes, you realize that maybe this is what he heard his father say about people.
What he heard more, what he heard his mother say. It was much more what he heard his mother say. Exactly. So he would like, he was clearly telling her version that he had heard and kind of incorporated and made them his own ideas, but it didn't really read very well when you're trying to tell a story through the eyes of a child. He's not going to say, Aunt Irma's complexion was so sallow, this would not be what a child would say. So I had to sort of reattribute the appropriate condemnations from the to the appropriate person, the judgmental grandmother, my grandmother. And he had to maintain the eyes of a child in seeing the things as they were. So that's where I took some artistic license, is to separate out what a child would observe, and then attribute those judgments to his judgmental mother. So I think that, there was a little bit of artistic, the facts are absolutely as they were, nothing was changed, but some of those observations I had to just sort out to get the right tone. And that took a little bit of work. And then also just to bring the reader into the story, because when a person is telling a story of what happened to them, they say things like, we would go to the park every Sunday. We would do this. We would do that. We would eat this. We would eat that. Well, that's not very fun reading, for a reader. You want to be there in the story. So you have to create something that, again, reads like a novel. And so, the whole style had to change so that you're brought in real time.
So Audrey, growing up with your father and that, did you find like when you write, do you write in first person or third person, or do you write in both?
Yeah, so again, I tried to write it in first person, but then I was like, no, it's not my story, and he's a boy and everything. So and it's got to be sort of his voice, even though it's my words. So I had tried that for a while. I tried first person, I tried present tense, but then it's 1930s, so I went to I'm a first time author, so other than writing medical chapters and consult notes, I had never done anything that was written creatively, except when I was 13. So it was my it took a few tries to see if I could do it. And I was like, can I bring a character into, can I bring the reader into a book if it's in the past tense and the third person? And the answer is a resounding yes, absolutely. You can definitely do it. And so yeah, the answer is yes. I figured out how to do it, and it can be done, and it's been done. And so it is written in the first person, but as he is the speaker. It's not me. He is the speaker. And it's past tense.
So, Audrey, before we get your cup of tea and I get your words from you, writing this story, did a lot of Holocaust survivors reach out to you or family members that were that had members that were survivors? Did they reach out after reading this story?
So I actually found family members through the process of writing this. I found family members because I was trying to like find my family history and find some of the people who I had written about, and I found a cousin. My father had come to this country with and a first cousin was here, and then they lost touch. There was like a family rift, and I found the daughter of that cousin, who would be my second cousin. And I looked her up and researched her and found her. And she lives a block and a half from my son in
Oh,
Chicago.
wow.
What are they? A block and a half. I mean, because Chicago is such a small town. Block and a half. And we've been
Wow.
in touch and we've met. And my son has been to, he went to breakfast with her on Yom Kippur. And she's a lovely woman my age, ish. And, that was an amazing thing. I'm also, some people, some relatives from Australia contacted me. It wasn't really through the book itself, but from just my efforts to try to find people in this process. And because I started a family tree and I started doing stuff in Ancestry and all that kind of stuff. And then you asked me another question and I was going to answer that. In terms of people reaching out. Yes, I am. So a couple of Holocaust survivor groups have reached out to me and asked me to speak at and give like a book signing live talk. So that seems to be definitely something that people are interested in. So that's because when I wrote the book, I mean, it wasn't just like, oh, I want to write a book. It was like, I think my father has a story that
Yeah.
I want to tell, because I think it's a story that needs to be told, like it's from an educational standpoint. And the more I could tell it to more people, I also want to tell it to young people. So I'm working with schools and school libraries to try to get the book. And because it has, I think it works for young adults too, because
Yeah.
it's told from his perspective of a young person. My father, from the time he's a child till he's in his early 20s, it works very well. It's very readable. So I'm trying to get it into, I have a couple of big school districts who are interested in it. So I think it spans quite a big range, readership. So that's the goal.
Well, sometimes the pain and the stories need to be told so we can educate, And I'm so glad that you're in the schools because we do need to get the younger generation to understand the history of what happened, right? And the story on how everybody got over here and how they still had a journey once they got here. We need to let those stories out. So, Audrey, I want to ask you, if I give you the letters TEA, what three words would you give me for a cup of tea?
Tolerance, empathy, and action.
Now, why those words?
Tolerance is two types of tolerance. Tolerance is like world tolerance, that we should be tolerant of people of different ethnicities and different sexual preferences and identities. And then there's like personal tolerance, like learning to become tolerant of people's individual traits, which is something that I feel I have to work on every day, like my own tolerance of, my husband and, things like that. Like it's a constant struggle to be accepting of people's, that they are who they are. They're individuals and they have their own stuff. And that's like, for me, like, I feel I'm better at the big tolerance, but I work, have to work harder at the little tolerance. So that's what I'm working on. Empathy, because I feel like if you, I think empathy, like, I actually am pretty good at. I think because I was from this sort of like somewhat abusively kind of background, it's unintentional abuse, I feel like I have empathy for people, for their struggles. I think, like, from a career in medicine, 35 years of medicine, I think I was able to have a lot of empathy for the struggles of families and what they were facing. But I think without empathy, you can't have tolerance. Like, if the two go hand in hand, you have to understand, and be able to put yourself in somebody else's shoes to understand. Like, even when they don't have ideas that are the same as yours, like, even if you're a Democrat and they're a Republican or whatever, like, you have to be able to understand people's, where they're coming from, or they're just, there can't be peace in the world and in your heart without that. And action, because I so often just hear people that complain about stuff and don't do anything. And I'm a person of action. So it's like, if you have a problem, okay, that's okay. And I understand. But now what are you going to do? That next
Yeah,
step, it's like, okay, what are
what's
you going to do now? Okay.
the solution?
Yeah, what's the solution? And even if that solution is, I don't know, but I'm going to talk to somebody, or I'm going to get help, or I'm going to ask for advice, or, like, that's an action step, but the doing nothing and the saying of, like, oh, I'm so upset that I'm overweight while you're eating, whatever. Like, okay, like, whatever you're upset about, like, whatever's bothering you, like, okay, and, so maybe the A is for and. So tolerance, empathy, and
You know, I actually like that. I like action and where are we going with this? I think because of having the history and the past that we both had, we're like, okay, what are you going to do about it? Like, are you going to just complain about it all the time? Or are you going to fix it? Like, you're going to find a solution,
You don't have to be on the world stage. You don't have to be like Greta Thunberg or whatever. But you could do, like, you could take a small step, make a phone call. You had a rift with a family member and you're upset about it, or, pick up the phone, write a letter, whatever it is. Like, I don't care what it is, but do something. Do something.
And that's the word that you gave me for when I asked you one word to describe yourself. You said that you were a doer. And now I understand it. I'm like, okay, I was wondering why you gave me the word doer, but now I get it. Now that I've sat with you and I'm just like, oh, I get it. Gotta do it. Like, just do something.
Yes, a Nike commercial.
So, Audrey, for if anybody would like to reach out to you, how can they reach out to you?
So my website is audreybirnbaumauthor.com. That's just for general, information about the book, and there's a lot of graphics about just past history and everything. But in terms of reaching me, I'm on social with most of the social is Audrey Birnbaum Author, whether it's Facebook or Instagram. So those are probably the best ways to find me.
So, and Audrey, before we wrap up, because we have less than 2 minutes here, what's the name of the second book, if you can give it away, or is it just the
Yeah, the
second
second
book?
book is fiction, but it's still, and it's a, it's an action and adventure, steamy. It's totally different kind of story, but it still focuses on relationships. It's interpersonal relationships, marriage and affairs, and all the deep stuff that is still, like, so critical. I think what makes American Wolf good is it's still, like, it's still a family story, and it's still about people and human nature. But the book is called The Climb.
The climb.
The
Oh.
climb, and it has a double meaning. So you can take of that what you will. So yes, it's I'm having really enjoy writing. It's so therapeutic. It's the only time I'm not busy doing 100 things is when I'm writing.
Well, I really appreciate your writing because these are incredible books. So if anybody would like to go and grab these books, check out the website. I believe they are on Barnes and Noble and Amazon as well. Check those out. Grab that book. Audrey, I really want to thank you for joining me on Tea Time today. I got to go back down a little bit down history lane as well, so I will be back at 3 p.m. and at 7 p.m. with two more tea times. Today is trigger day warning, so I'm just giving everybody heads up. The second guest that will be up at 3 p.m. is Richard Sparks. He's a comedian writer, and we're going to talk about his life journey on writing, and then we're going to finish up with Sherry Aikens, and she'll be talking about a real life murder that happened in Canada. So we'll be doing a lot of trigger warnings. So if you can't tune in, no hard feelings. Miss Liz understands. And again, Audrey, I want to thank you for joining me and having a good, strong cup of tea. And keep serving that tolerance, empathy, and action and solutions to make a better life and a better cup of tea at the end of the day.
Thank
Until
you,
then, I'll.
Miss Liz. I'm so sorry for your loss, too, really. But thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome.